Today is Monday, September 21, 2020. This is a part four Grand Canyon oral history interview with Kurt Sauer, S-A-U-E-R. My name is Tom Martin. And good morning, Kurt. How are you today?
Morning, Tom. I'm fine. Hope you're well, too.
I am. Thank you, sir. May we have your permission to record this interview over the telephone?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. We had left off in the summer of 1979, when you were offered a job at Grand Canyon National Park as a permanent job, and you were a GS-6 in the pay scale, and this job was a GS-3, and you were offered the dispatch position. Can you pick that story up from there?
Well, sure. I was working seasonally at Rocky Mountain, and that had been my fourth or fifth year as a seasonal ranger at Rocky. I'd been trying to get on, as so many other seasonal rangers had been, trying to get on permanent with the National Park Service. And because I'd been working winters at Grand Canyon, summers at Rocky Mountain, the previous winter I'd gone down to Phoenix and taken an OPM clerk test in order to be able to apply for dispatch jobs. And dispatch was one of the paths into the Park Service at Grand Canyon. The chief ranger used it to bring rangers in, and so you were given the opportunity to get permanent by taking a GS-3 dispatch position. Might have been a GS-3/4 slash 5, and so I accepted the job, reported in June 1st, and about a week off around my birthday, July 20th, and July 27th, got married in Rocky Mountain National Park. My wife and I jumped in the car the day after and drove through Farmington, I believe, New Mexico. Right before dusk, we had a mountain lion run across the road in front of us. And
wow.
Took that good omen. Stayed someplace in Mexico in that area, and then showed up to Grand Canyon the next day. Went into seasonal quarters, which allowed dogs, and over at Albright Training Center, Building E. And then started work as a dispatcher.
So can we back up for a minute to the clerk test that you took in December? What was that test like? What kind of stuff were they asking you?
You know, I don't remember the questions. They were basic arithmetic, maybe some logic. What I do remember is your answer sheet was a computer punch card.
Hmm.
And the way you were supposed to pick your answers was they gave you a stick pin, which was about half an inch long, with a big round, with a, I don't know, 3/16 of an inch diameter ball on the end of it, so you didn't prick your finger.
Right.
And you had to push all these, later became well known as chads, push all these chads out of the answer box. And I think that might have been a dexterity test. I never could figure that out. Why you couldn't hold on to a pencil and punch them out with your pencil lead, beyond me. But so, I don't know. Took 45 minutes or something to take that test.
Okay.
And then they put all the computer punch cards in the system, and they gave you your rating. And then you got rated on the register, and the park received that register and whatever rules they had to follow at the time. If you were in the top three, you could be offered a job. So that was a pretty weird test for me just because of that push pin.
Hmm. Okay. And also, you mentioned that the dispatch job was a GS3/4/5. What exactly does that mean?
It means that if you work in that position for 1 year, you can go from a GS3 to a GS4.
Okay.
If you work another year, you can go from a 4 to a 5. And then that's the maximum you can get paid in that position.
Okay.
Well, the Ranger positions were, technicians were GS6, 7, and the Park Ranger position was GS7, GS9. General Field Ranger.
Okay.
So District Rangers and Sub-District Rangers were, actually Sub-District Rangers I think were 9s, District Rangers were 11, Chief Ranger was 12, 13 depending on the park.
Okay.
And superintendents were 14, 15 depending on the park's complexity, its political sensitivity.
Okay.
And I'm not sure whether or not the senior executive service system of payment existed in the 70s for the National Park Service, but nowadays many superintendents are senior executive service, which is a higher pay grade than a GS-15.
Okay.
So it's just a progression, and as long as you do well and don't get fired, in a year's time you're guaranteed a pay raise up to your max. In the case of the dispatcher, it's a GS-5, I think, at the time.
Okay. So you took the test, and had your birthday, you got married, you saw a mountain lion. That's pretty neat. And you showed up the Albright quarters are these long rows of buildings. There were an upstairs and a downstairs. Can you describe that some?
Well, there's five there at that time. There were five dormitories or apartment complexes. They weren't dorms. And there were probably four apartments on the bottom, four apartments on the top, maybe five. We stayed in a one-bedroom apartment and had an efficiency kitchen. The sink was about 14 inches by 14 inches with a refrigerator under the counter. That was it. And buildings A through D were for the Albright students. And because the park was short on housing for park personnel, they had worked out an agreement with the Albright Training Center, Grand Canyon, that building E was for Park Service permanent employees. And you stayed there until you were able to bid on houses that came open. So if somebody was living in a house and they transferred, or they happened to bid on a larger house and their house came open, then you could bid on it. And if you had enough, it was your pay grade, size of your family, your time in service, maybe a couple other criteria. So we probably lived there for about 6 months before Cabin 16 came open.
Okay.
And we successfully bid on that. Actually, I think that gets me to the first recollection of a fellow by the name of Dick Marks, who was the superintendent after Merle Stitt. And I'm not sure of the exact time frame, but I put in my bid for Cabin 16, which was a one-bedroom and had a, well, probably used to be a woodshed. It was one of the old train station employee, train company's housing, and you walked down out of the living room into this 8 foot wide by maybe 12 foot long room, and the argument with the housing committee was whether or not it was one bedroom or two bedrooms. We weren't We weren't eligible to bid on two bedrooms, and I bid on it anyway. And they couldn't decide amongst themselves, so I got pushed up to the superintendent, and Dick Marks, I was told, went over and took a look at the cabin and said, "This is a one bedroom." So we were eligible to bid, and we were successful in that bid, so we moved out all right after about 6 or 8 months of living in an efficiency one bedroom apartment.
You know, let's back up a little bit, because I think Superintendent Marks would have been new to the job there, like you were in dispatching, though you weren't new to Grand Canyon. In the 70s, when you were there, there was a superintendent named Merle Stitt, S-T-I-T-T. Did you have any interactions with Superintendent Stitt?
Yeah, I had two interactions with Mr. Stitt. The first one was sometime in the first week of my job. I was taken up to meet the superintendent, and that was his policy. I knew him, he that came to the park. He wanted to meet him, talk to him, and just know who was working for him.
Okay.
And again, he was a throwback to the way the Park Service used to be. Kindly gentleman. I remember his secretary, I don't remember her name, but she was just always pleasant and very pleased to be working for Merle. And, you know, we probably had about a 15-minute conversation. And again, just like my comments about being at Phantom Ranch and, oh, by the way, the director of the Park Service is going to show up on a riverboat. Just got on permanent, and now I'm going to go meet the superintendent of the national park. And that was like pretty impressive to me that superintendents were like that.
Nice.
And you know, Superintendent Roger Contour at Rocky Mountain had been pretty much the same way. He was a little bit more aloof, but it seems like. Thinking back on it, seems like in the 70s, maybe even the 80s, it was expected that you would be brought to the superintendent's office and introduced, part of the Park Service family. So that was my first interaction with Merle Stitt. The second one that I remember quite clearly wasn't more of an indirect interaction with Merle Stitt. When I was the dispatcher, because I had worked on South Rim Patrol, when they needed additional patrol and I was off duty as a dispatcher, I would work as a patrol ranger. And I was going to mention to you that I think the experience on being on patrol for 3 years and working with the fire brigade and working with Erie Council on EMT's response helped me out quite a bit in helping to dispatch rangers on calls. But anyway, I was a new permanent dispatcher and went out and worked ranger patrol as a GS3 dispatcher. And I'm not sure if it was 79 or I'm not sure when Merle Stitt left.
Yeah.
He was still there. And I was out on a night patrol, and one of the things that we worked on was people that had been drinking out in Tucson coming back into the park. And I stopped a car on the way back into the park inside the park that seemed to be weaving to me, and ended up having pulled over the North Rim manager, a fellow by the name of Rick Gale, who had been drinking, and was with another female employee whose name I don't remember. So now I put myself in a position as the new dispatcher, having stopped Rick Gale.
Working road patrol. Okay.
And Rick was kind of one of the men that you didn't mess with. He had a reputation. During that car stop, he assisted me involuntarily, as far as I was concerned, with administering the breath alcohol analyzer by grabbing it out of my hands and blowing into it and blowing up the balloon. And came back over the legal limit, and he became quite boisterous and said, you don't know what you're doing. You don't know how to operate that. So you put this in wrong, you put that in wrong, and I'm going home. I said, well, no, you're not going home, not if you're driving, but you can have your person in the car drive you home. And so off they went after I had checked her out, and went back into dispatch after that car stop. And I'm going, you won't believe what I just did. I'm screwed. Then the phone rings, and it's Rick Gale calling dispatch, and he wants to talk to the ranger that stopped him. And the dispatcher says, well, he's standing right here. Let me put you on the phone. And he continued a conversation with a bit of a tirade about how I didn't know what I was doing, and et cetera, et cetera, and then hung up. Well, when you call dispatch, it's all recorded.
Ah.
So the next day, called, well, I didn't call. Ernie Kessel called me. When you get off duty from dispatch, I want you over in my office. And so I went over, and he said, I've listened to the recording that dispatch from last night told me about, and I just want you to know that I'm going to Merle Stitt. And he said, okay, great. Like, shall I start packing my bag? So anyway, Superintendent Stitt found out about the situation, listened to the recording, and called Mr. Gale and told Mr. Gale that if he wanted to keep his job, he was going to apologize to Dispatcher Sauer. Well, it took Mr. Gale about 2 weeks to finally apologize in person, which he did.
Okay.
And that was my second indirect interaction with Superintendent Stitt. As I was told, I never talked to him about the incident. As I was told, he was somewhat irritated. So that was in the late 70s. And I'm sure all the parties in the story have their perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I recollect.
But yeah, this is an interesting issue of what happens when a junior employee that's a law enforcement officer pulls over a superior employee who is legally over the legal limit for drinking.
Exactly. And not unusual in this country or any country.
Sure.
But I experienced it firsthand, that's for sure. And I think that's the only time that I had an employee that I stopped that was over the legal limit.
Hmm.
And in hindsight, I was quite intimidated. And I'd say I chose to take the low road, so by letting him go. But what I should have done was call a supervisor.
Ah.
But that's what I did.
Yep. You mentioned that your 3 years working winters seasonally at Grand Canyon was very helpful for you as a dispatcher. Can you expand on that?
I'm sure. It's the same as working in the backcountry permit office and never going in the backcountry. You try and interpret the rules and educate the visitor, but until you get out in the field, you just don't know. At that time, my recollection is that we had periodic ride-alongs with dispatchers, but they were not routine. Just because there weren't that many dispatchers, and you send somebody out on patrol, and you got to pay somebody else overtime. Very seldom were there two dispatchers working. So I had the field experience, and I knew where everything was in the village. Every hotel, every restaurant, every bar, every trailhead, and so did all the other patrol managers. So when you got a dispatch call, many times the dispatchers didn't know exactly where they were talking about sending you. And when the fire alarms went off, we were used to responding. So as a dispatcher, I was already used to the emergency calls for fire alarms or heart attacks or whatever, and allowed me to be calm. Another fellow by the name of Mike Ebersol is a dispatcher, and he also had similar field experience. It just helped in dispatching resources. You knew how long it was going to take someone to get there. You knew who was closest. And you knew how long it was going to take them to get to the fire engine or the ambulance. That type of experience was good.
You know, now that you've explained it, this makes an awful lot of sense. To take seasonal law enforcement rangers that have canyon experience, whether it was South Rim or Corridor, backcountry, and get them into the dispatch where they can work on being calm, cool, and collected, and they know where to send people. This is what's happening. This is the incident. This is where you need to go. That's pretty clever.
Also allowed the chief ranger and his district rangers to pick the cream of the crop, keep them on the dispatch cert, and bring them into the park service.
Nice. Clever. Clever might not be the right word. I think maybe smart or, you know, it sounded like good strategy. You mentioned Mike Ebersol. Can you spell Mike's last name?
I think it's E-B-E-R-S-O-L-E, Ebersol. And it's S-O-L.
What do you remember about Mike back then?
Cool, calm, and collected.
Uh-huh.
Always interested in aviation. In fact, he became the aviation officer for the Park Service, I believe, sometime after I left. I'll tell you what I remember most about Mike is he's the reason that I got promoted. Mike did a little digging into the rules and regulations and discovered that since we had been GS-5s, okay, sixes in my career, that we should have been hired as GS-4s.
Oh.
And that didn't go over well at all with the powers that be. But Mike was insistent. So I think 3 months after I was dispatching, we both got a promotion to GS-4, with retroactive back pay.
Ooh.
Because the hiring process has been that way.
Oops.
And, of course, that didn't make any friends with the personnel office.
No, and the budget office either.
And the budget office, yeah. Another 27 cents an hour. But it allowed us to progress from GS3 to a 5, replace that with progressing from a GS4 to a GS5.
Mm-hmm.
Which was instrumental in my getting my next job. I was in there long enough to become a GS5. And then the next job was as a river unit permit manager, working for Steve Martin and in the river unit. And that was a GS7 position.
Okay.
So,
well, before we get there, let's back up a little bit. And where was the dispatch office, and what did it look like?
Well, the dispatch office was at headquarters. You went in the main doors of headquarters into the visitor center. Off to the left are a couple of double doors that lead out to a plaza, which at that time had four or five old wooden dories that had been used by river runners historically.
Uh-huh.
I don't remember the names of them, but who they were owned by, but they were on display in the courtyard underneath an overhang. And you walked through that courtyard to the far left corner, and you went through a locked door, and that's where the chief law enforcement officer's office was, Lloyd Honer, shared with Michael Swickard, and the dispatch office. And the dispatch office, I'm going to guess, was 20 feet by 20 feet. Had a fax machine. The most interesting thing it had was I think they're called PBX telephone system.
Hmm.
And I mentioned this earlier. He had little headphones on with a microphone that came in front of your face. And the best way to visualize this is Lily Tomlin on whatever that show was, Rowan and Martin.
Yep.
When she was, the phone would ring and you would pull a cord out of the panel on your desk and you'd plug it in so you could take the incoming call. And they would ask to talk to extension 223 or 147. You pull out another cord, you plug it into the appropriate extension, and the phone in that office starts ringing. And if you worked it right, you could just sit there and listen to the phone call, which I didn't do very much. But it was... It was just like Lily Tomlin, and you got this whole board in front of you with all these wires and all these holes that you plug stuff into, and wires are running and crisscrossing and whatnot. And it took about a week to figure that out and get used to it. But that's how you answered the phone.
This sounds like something from the 1950s. I mean, that building was built in... mid to late 1950s, and that would have been a state-of-the-art phone back then. And here it is, maybe 20 years later,
mm-hmm.
25 going on, still there.
Yeah, I don't know how long it took to come up with enough money to replace that with an updated system.
So your job as dispatcher was also phone operator.
Yeah.
Okay. So that When things were busy in dispatch world, that would be kind of unnerving to have to, you know, connect, you know, regular park business on phone. How did you kind of juggle that out?
Well, regular dispatch calls were handled like regular phone calls, but car stops and emergencies took precedence.
Okay.
So if there's something going on, the phone didn't get answered.
Got it.
Or if you were fortunate enough to have two dispatchers, one of them was running the phones and one of them was running the radio.
Sure. And was the radio there as a kind of big box on a table? How did that work out?
I don't recall how big a box it was, but there was a microphone on the table that you sat at. And you just pressed the lever on the front of it to activate it. And I don't remember exactly where the phone or the radio system actually sat, but all you had was a microphone on your desk.
Okay. And this giant phone connection system with all these little cables and pins to place in. Was that, what, 4 feet wide, roughly? 3 feet high?
Yeah, something like that.
Okay.
Yeah, you could reach everything, and you could see over the top of it. And it was about 2 feet away. So must not have been too big.
And you would have known Swickert and Horner,
mm-hmm.
Because you'd been there for 3 years, and I can't remember if I asked you about Lloyd Horner. I think I
don't think so.
Okay. What do you remember about Lloyd?
Tall, thin, professional. Now, he was clean cut. It, 60s kind of officer, I guess, 60s and 70s. Clean cut, care. He was the prosecutor for the Park Service when we went to the magistrate's office for court. Always had his ducks in a row. And that's pretty much what I recall. He was warm. He wasn't extremely outgoing, but he treated you fair.
Mm-hmm. So he was getting ready to retire at that time, or was he still going to be in the service for another 10 to 15 years?
I don't really know the answer to that.
Okay.
He was 50? I don't know.
Okay. And then your shift was running, were you working all different shifts, or how did that work out?
Yeah, there were three different shifts. 8 to 4. Yeah, whatever they were. 12 to 8. 8 to 4 and 4 to 12. Graveyard. And you just rotated. I think it was every week.
Okay.
Might have been every 2 weeks, but frequently in the summer your shifts were longer. Some second dispatcher would come in, but it was so busy that you would stay.
Would you get overtime for that, or was that just on your own?
No, you got overtime. You stayed in.
Okay.
Your supervisor would determine whether or not you stayed or left.
All right. And clearly working graveyard, it would have been a little quieter, one would assume.
Yeah, that's when you worked on court records and filing.
And what did that entail?
Just keeping the court records, you know, the cases would be completed and reports would have been written and filing the those and filing the case incident reports that had been received and reviewed by the supervisors, keeping track of the citations, making sure they've been mailed off correctly.
Okay.
Just general paperwork for the law enforcement function.
All right. And at this time, were you also, you'd been a volunteer with the fire team. Were you still carrying that on?
Yeah, but it wasn't as a volunteer. It was whenever I worked seasonally or as a dispatcher, if there was training or there was a call that I responded to, if you were working, you got paid regular time. If you were off duty and you responded, then you got overtime.
Okay.
And if there was an actual fire, you got hazard duty pay.
All right.
And you wanted to always work on Sundays because you got an extra 10%.
All right. What was your wife doing at this time?
She was a leather worker. She's a craftsman.
Oh, okay.
So when we got married, she left a job working at an awning shop, but she also had her own industrial sewing machine. So she was making leather garments, and that wasn't bringing in a lot of money, but it's something that she liked. And she ended up getting a job at Grand Canyon Helicopters.
Huh.
Out in TCN as a front desk greeter and off a helicopter loader. So she got to know the helicopter pilots very well that I had been flying with and continued to fly with on emergency responses in the canyon. I think she did that until we left.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, and then she also had a baby. So that was in 1983.
Okay. All right. What else do you remember about working dispatch?
Well, it was interesting. I would rather have been out doing the work, but it was a way to get into the Park Service.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of camaraderie. People depended a lot on the dispatchers. Dispatchers always felt like they had to make sure everything was flowing as smoothly as it could behind the scenes. And learned when I was working seasonally that they did a good job, and I intended to continue to do that. So it was most of the time it was routine. And especially during graveyards, it was very quiet. Once you got the paperwork done, it was just make sure that you don't fall asleep.
Yes.
Phone rings, because there was no one on patrol.
Oh.
After 2 after 2 p.m. or after they got done wrapping up all the drunks coming out of the bars.
Right.
So after 3 or 4 p.m. certainly, there was nobody on duty until 6. So from 3, 4 until 6 o'clock in the morning, it was you and the PBX.
Okay.
And nobody was calling. You get the occasional call, but people generally inebriated, wondering how long it would take them to get to South Rim of the Grand Canyon from Phoenix, because they were just leaving the bar. They decided that they wanted to come to the Grand Canyon.
Hmm.
Just kooky things like that. And not a whole lot of people came in to dispatch administration. The only people that came in routinely were the Rangers.
Okay.
It was a place where the rest of the staff wasn't supposed to go.
Right.
It was quiet. It was routine. And then something would happen and we'd be busy for a couple hours.
And I would imagine this would give you pretty good training to understand all facets of what was happening in the park. Because dispatch was also, were you also fielding maintenance calls?
Yeah, we didn't have that many maintenance calls. Most of the maintenance was dispatching themselves, talking to each other.
Okay.
But you had, yeah, you received and listened to calls from Desert View on the east end of the park, the north rim, south rim, inner canyon. So you were talking to the Rangers that were stationed all over the park if they needed something. So you're listening to the radio all day long and you can fairly well burst that's a Chinook fire helicopter flying over the house right now. Close the window.
Has that been happening for a while?
Well, there's a new fire out by Palm Springs. Three days ago, it was 250 acres, and I think it's about 7,000 acres now.
Whoa.
And the El Dorado fire is just 5 to 7 miles north and west of us. Started 12 days ago. And then the Apple fire was, three and a half weeks ago. That was half a mile away. So there's a recharge pond that the local water district has. They're bringing water in from the state water project to recharge the aquifer. And there's the large, probably 3-acre pond, probably 3 feet of water in it. So the Chinook snorkel Chinooks come over and hover above the pond and takes them about 30 seconds to pick up 2,000 gallons of water, and then they head back to the fire where they were sunning.
Wow. That's impressive. To move that amount of water that fast.
Yeah. And there's been lots of retardant tankers flying over, too. So. And they're at about 3,000-4,000 feet above ground level when they're coming in for their approach. They circle around and get a little bit lower. A couple of shots of them about 300 feet off the deck, dropping retardant on the other end.
Well, hang in there. Hope the wind keeps going away from you toward the fire. So.
Yeah. Well, we're all good.
Yeah.
We've been safe through all of them.
Good. Yeah, just thinking about dispatch in general gives you a chance to know who all the employees are, issues that they're dealing with. Were you guarded with your time off, or did you use as much of your time off as you could to work overtime and do other things there?
I used as much of my time as I could to continue being active in ranger operations.
Okay.
Whatever it was. So that I didn't get forgotten about in dispatch.
All right.
And also, because it was fun.
Yep.
You can go hiking in the Grand Canyon, that's fun. My wife and I hiked quite a bit, day hikes. But I was still, especially as a seasonal, still very interested in getting on permanent.
Okay.
And when I'm permanent, I was very interested in getting back into the Ranger series.
Okay.
And doing Ranger work. So, yeah, any time I could volunteer for Ranger activities, that was what I did.
Nice.
Or once I was permanent, I shouldn't say volunteer, I made myself available for pay.
Okay.
And I wasn't getting paid, and there were probably some times that I just volunteered to do some work anyway, just to stay active.
Okay. Besides Mike, who else, do you remember who else was working dispatch?
One gal by the name of Jana, I don't remember her last name. Is Paul Anderson there then? No. Yeah, no, I don't remember any of the names.
Okay.
Jana Grover.
Sorry?
Jana Grover, the wife of Hal Grover.
How do you spell that?
G-R-O-V-E-R-T.
And Joanna, J-O-A-N-N-A?
No, just Jana, J-A-N-A.
Thank you.
And Hal.
And what did Hal do?
South Rim Patrol.
Okay.
He was a Rocky Mountain boy.
Ah, okay. Was he permanent?
Yes.
Okay.
I'm not sure where he got on permanent, but he transferred into Grand Canyon.
All right. And so at this time, Ernie is still there, Ernie Kunzel?
Yes.
And he's still pushing Park Ranger EMT training.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. You mentioned a couple times you were doing the Lily Tomlin listening in on the phone thing. What kind of stuff would you learn doing that?
Oh, I was just listening to conversations.
Okay.
I really didn't learn much. I didn't do it that many times. One of the dispatchers showed me how to do it. He was like, "You gotta be kidding me."
Huh.
Well, then I figured, this probably isn't a really good idea.
Not without a warrant.
I'm sorry, I just forgot to flip this particular toggle switch.
Yeah.
Yeah, phone lines weren't real secure there.
Then. And who was your was Lloyd your boss? Who was your direct boss?
I think Lloyd was on paper was my direct boss, but Swigert was the guy we interacted with. Dave Swigert. He was also the range master.
What's a range master?
Well, it takes you out to the range and supervises and qualifies you.
Okay.
He's in charge of safety of the range and training exercises and qualifications.
All right.
So he was a South Rim Patrol Ranger. Probably supervisor of some sort. I don't know if he was a, I don't know what his actual title was. But yeah, I think he supervised dispatch and went out on patrol himself. But he was comparable to Ernie Kunzel.
Okay.
And his degree of responsibility.
Okay. So before you became a dispatcher, when you were doing the seasonal in Rocky Mountain and seasonal at Grand Canyon, you would be able to work in a volunteer river trip in there. Now as dispatcher, did you have to walk away from the river, or were you able to maintain a connection there on the water?
I believe that I took one or two, must have taken a couple, of partial river trips. And have enough time, take some time off with your days off, and or you just get to go on paid status, which I don't recall that happening very much. So if the river trip launched, and by then, Park Service had converted to oar power. And so the 5 days, 6-7 day river trip on motors became 14 days.
Okay.
So you could leave on day one, ride up to Lee's Ferry with the boat crew, launch, and get to Phantom Ranch in the 7th day. And then you hike out.
Okay.
Or you could hike down the Hans Trail or the Tanner Trail and hike out Hermit Creek for a 3 day, two or 3 day trip. Or you could go Phantom Ranch to Diamond Creek for another 7 day trip. So a couple of different times I did that, whether it was paid or off, I don't recall. But I became friends with Steve Martin, Sam West, John Thomas, eventually Kim Crumbo, and also I mentioned that my wife Connor was a seamstress and worked in canvas and leather primarily. And she actually designed the bilge bags for the patrol boats.
Ah.
Sewed them up. And of course, you got to know how such things function. So she volunteered for several river trips and saw what was needed in the design to fit the boat and how it was used. And she made bilge bags and several other accessories for the boats and boatmen. So she was able to get on the river as well. And she also volunteered as a camp cook. And at the time, I don't remember when Cindy Burns showed up on the river. She was hired as the cook. I don't know if it was 79 and 80 or 82, someplace in there. And there was another gal by the name of Ruth Ann Murray, who I had met, and she was a Bisbee, Arizona cowgirl. And I mean cowgirl.
Okay.
She could hold a calf down and brand it and take a lick of chew, all at the same time. The first time I saw her take a dip, she just opened up her can of chew and licked up the bunch of chew and put it in her mouth, closed the lid, put it back in her pocket all the same hand. I said, Vicki, how do you do that? No, you just do it like this. I said, why do you do that? Well, when you're out branding, one of your hands is all bloody. Both of your hands are bloody. And you can't be putting blood in your mouth. And, oh, okay. So you can put chew in your mouth. And not blood. That's good. And then about 6 months later, I started chewing. So anyway. So Connor was on the river quite a bit. She learned what was needed as far as equipment. She helped Cindy with the cooking. And then it came time, this is later, this is 82, 81, 82. The boat men decided that it was time that Cindy Burns became a boat woman. And she said, well, I can't cook and row. And rowing is fairly strenuous. And then you want me to get off the boat and then cook dinner.
Right.
And cook. And I said, you know, I know somebody that'd be willing to go down there and learn how to cook. So we went over and talked with Ruthie. And she sort of looked at us like, I would love to do this, but you guys need to know that I don't know how to cook. She said, well, we'll teach you. So Ruth Ann became the understudy for Cindy Burns, and she would come over to our house, and Connor would teach her how to cook some other things in a regular kitchen. And she became the cook, and Ruthie became not the first riverboat woman for us. I forget her name. But Cindy became a full-time boatman, and Ruth Ann became a full-time cook, and she eventually learned how to row. And then she ended up marrying a fellow that ended up owning one of the river companies.
Okay.
Names I don't recall. But or just another example of a tight-knit family. Anyway.
Okay.
Somewhere around 1980, 81, the river unit started issuing, I think the plan was either going, the river, Colorado River Management Plan, either going into effect or went into effect. And instead of like 5 or 10% of the use permits going to private river runners, 30% went to private river runners, and 70% was reserved for the commercial. Maybe it's 80-20. I don't remember the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But the demand for private river running by then was so high that they decided that they would have a lottery. And they needed somebody to administer the lottery and keep track of all the applications and make sure people were qualified and there wasn't any shenanigans going on. So a river unit permit management position came open at a GS-7.
Ooh.
Ranger tech, or technician, I think it was. And I was fortunate enough to be hired for that job by Steve Martin.
Okay.
So that was probably 80, I don't know the call, 80, 81.
Worked
for Steve. Art Jensen was in charge of the river unit at the time.
Let's back up a little bit. 79, 80 was the river unit. There was a small time in there where they were running dories. Is that right?
I think they may have taken dories as an experiment.
Okay.
But as far as I recall, there were always rafts accompanying the dories.
Okay.
As opposed to Martin Litton's outfit. Yeah. never rode on a dory, so I don't know what the trips looked like. When I was there, it was always rafts. Kim Johnson, another boatwoman, I think took kayaks occasionally.
Okay.
Mostly it was just river rafts or power rafts.
You had mentioned, I was thinking of Kim, when you mentioned that before Cindy was a boatman, there was another female boatman before her. If you remember who that is, I'd sure like to know.
I think it was Mary Lou Maurer, M-O-W-E-R.
Did you ever meet her?
Yeah.
What was she like?
how would you describe Mary Lou Maurer? Full of energy. Good boat woman. The only best of them.
Okay.
Might have been there for 1 or 2 years. And most probably, she was a boatwoman for a commercial operation.
Okay.
Otherwise, the park didn't go out and hire people that never rode a boat, I can tell you that.
Right.
So, Sam West, John Thomas, Kim Crumbo, Kim Johnson. They were the ones that figured out who the seasonals would be. Seasonal boatmen.
We've been going for about an hour. I'm ready to jump into this. Unless there's anything else you want to bring in about dispatch.
No. Anything else? I do know that it taught me that...
I'm sorry.
I do know that it taught me that dispatchers carry a lot of responsibility.
Yes.
So when I hear the 9/11 calls nowadays, and people are so inclined to criticize what's going on with dispatching, I have the behind-the-scenes experience to know those people are under a lot of stress.
Yes.
Anyway, now hold on as well. I'll get that. Don't leave me a message.
Yes, indeed, a lot of stress. And yet they have to be calm, cool, and collected.
Mm-hmm.
And, get the job done. And in big parks, in big, busy parks, that's a lot of responsibility.
Yeah, and the police departments and the fire dispatch.
Hmm.
And we just had a firefighter killed here a couple days ago on the El Dorado fire. And I would not want to be the dispatchers on duty when that occurred.
Hmm.
No. Full on rescue operation. Went missing. They still haven't announced how he died.
Hmm.
That was a hot shot that got separated from his team. And, they're all going through dispatch, and the dispatchers are probably previous firefighters.
Right.
All you can do is sit there and dispatch. So, anyway, I got a lot of respect for those people.
Yes. So I'm thinking about your career up to this point, very well versed in fire and in South Rim Road Patrol work. How was it that you looked at a river unit permit manager job? Yes, it was a GS-7, but it would seem as though it would be taking you away from being a law enforcement ranger.
Well, I didn't view myself as a law enforcement ranger. I viewed myself as a national park ranger.
Okay.
And it's actually something that bothers me, the transition that occurred. And there'll be a little background noise here. I've got to walk out front and make sure delivery's not here.
Okay.
Yeah, we're good.
Can you speak to this? Yeah. Because this was happening right about this time, I think. This.
Yep. Yeah, I think it was 74. I forget the name of the law. But anyway, when I came into the Park Service as a seasonal, rangers were expected to do everything. We did the resource management work. We did the firefighting. We did the emergency medicine. We did the law enforcement. And we did the visitor service and interpretation. Although interpretation had broken out of the ranger responsibility probably in the 60s.
Okay.
You had park rangers and you had park interpreters. Well, they're both park rangers.
Right.
They started becoming called interpreters, and they specialized in interpretation. When I worked seasonally at Rocky, I remember 76, 77, 78, someplace in there, there was a big hubbub in the park because the park was getting a resource management specialist, and he was going to be in charge of resource management.
Ah.
And it's like, what do we need that guy for? Well, so resource management over the years, and rightfully so, as it turns out, has the responsibility for resource management has been taken away from the park ranger. And you have biologists, you have botanists, you have a whole range of ologists, which the parks needed and didn't have up until that time. And maybe if we wouldn't have had, things were different in the 50s, 60s, mm-hmm. of course, in the understanding of the environment. But you wouldn't have had all the mountain lions being shot at the Grand Canyon. You wouldn't have had all the wolves being shot at the various northern Rocky parks. Because maybe there would have been a greater understanding of how the, quote, ecosystem works.
Right.
How Mother Earth works. But these were things that we did, and eventually the fire profession split off, and rangers are still doing emergency medical services, but now if you're an EMT or a paramedic, you're stationed at parks, and that's what you respond to at Yosemite. And so from 74 until whenever, the park ranger title has now become park law enforcement officer. And I didn't get into being a national park ranger so that I could be a law enforcement officer.
Okay.
I got into the park service because back then, the park ranger did park ranger work. And now they've been stovepiped. And, even on the river, I think Mark Law, maybe in his discussions with you, at some point in there, when the river unit patrolled the river, we were just boatmen going down the river, and we had the authority to write tickets, hardly ever wrote tickets. didn't carry weapons, didn't have bulletproof, bullet-resistant vests, didn't have our defensive equipment belts on, and then that occurred. So on the south rim, even at Joshua Tree, someplace in that 15-year period, the park ranger started called the law enforcement officer.
Okay.
And I see it needed. The law enforcement that folks deal with now in the parks is so much more complex and so much more dangerous than what we were dealing with in the 60s and 70s. I forget when, 74, 75. Yeah, it must have been 74. We were required to wear firearms. Well, the big argument in the Park Service at the time, and it was up to the superintendents, was whether or not you could wear your firearm into headquarters. So you're out on patrol, and you're required to wear a firearm. You don't have a bullet-resistant vest. You might have a shotgun. You don't have a semi-automatic rifle. And you pull into headquarters, and before you can go into headquarters or Rocky Mountain National Park, you have to take your clip-on holster off, lock it up in your glove box, and then you can go into headquarters. And then when you get done at headquarters, you can go back out to your patrol car or your patrol truck, get your weapon out of the glove box, and go out on patrol. And when you're out on hunting patrol, you've got your, at the time, revolver and eventually semi-automatic on your defensive equipment, and you're carrying your shotgun or your rifle. But when you come into headquarters, all that stuff has to stay in your vehicle. And eventually, the Park Service, we resolved that, and we went away from 2-inch revolvers to 4-inch barreled revolvers, the semi-automatic weapons. And it's just that whole progression of law enforcement being accepted. You were expected to do law enforcement in the early 70s, but you weren't expected, you were expected to not let it show at headquarters.
Right.
And just inane. But that's where the Park Service was. I remember, I think it was the Colorado State game wardens went through the same thing.
Interesting.
Now, the most fatality-wise, at least in the 70s and the 80s, maybe it's not that way now, the most dangerous profession in law enforcement was a state game warden. Primarily because during hunting season, when you went out, everybody that you encountered had weapons, and everybody that you encountered, well, some high percentage of everybody you encountered, had been drinking.
Huh.
And they would have taken a deer or an elk, and you're supposed to go into camp and make sure they took it legally.
Right.
And, you know, when they didn't, or those non-sportsman hunters who were just out hunting because they, you know, whatever reason they were hunting.
Mm-hmm.
The game wardens ended up getting shot.
Right.
And finally, they adequately equipped them with the appropriate equipment and the appropriate staffing. But, I mean, it's just this progression over the last 30 years, 40 years of park rangers, forest rangers. Let's skip that story. Game wardens. I've always been at risk, and it's gotten worse.
Right.
It's gotten much worse. Anyway, I got off on a tangent. But I wasn't leaving dispatch. I wasn't leaving the ranger operation. I was going to be doing ranger work, in my perspective, ranger work in the river unit. Because I saw the folks that were running the river, they're river rangers.
Yes.
And that's what they were respected, and that's mm-hmm. how they were treated. And we'd pull in the camps and to inspect the concessioners. Of course, they're all good friends. River runners that were working for the Park Service were some of the most respected for their skills in river running. Kim Crumbo, for his knowledge of geology and his passion for the park.
Uh-huh.
And, pulling, hey, hi, Bruce, how's it going? Hey, good, we got some coffee on. Okay, we need to inspect your camp. Okay. Yeah, Bruce, we just inspected your camp. We know what kind of camp you run. So, river runners at that time, by far and away in commercial, took excellent care of the Grand Canyon. And it was the private river runners that needed to be looked after.
Okay.
Just because they were experienced and they took on some challenges with food handling and garbage disposal and whatnot. The commercial river runners, you run a 7-day trip or a 14-day trip, 3 days later you're back on the river. That's your home for 6 months.
Right.
And you take care of it. So, going into the river unit at the time was an opportunity, to become a GS-7,
uh-huh.
which was because because you make more money.
Right.
And it was, by that time I'd fallen in love with the entire length of the Grand Canyon. So
right.
I didn't go very first year, but I was able to get on several river trips. And setting up that lottery system was I wouldn't call it a farce, but we were using a word processing computer to have it generate random numbers. And I'm the one that tried to figure out how to get a word processing unit to generate random numbers.
Whoa.
And it's about as random as you can get, I guess. So anyway, we're in the permit office, and Marv and Steve were dealing with the politics of the implementation of the river management plan. And Rumbo and John Thomas and Sam West and Kim were running the river. And we were a pretty tight-knit bunch.
Nice. So, Kurt, we've got some out-of-town guests that have just walked in. My wife is yik-yakking with them in the other room, and I'm going to have to run away now. But
okay.
I would like to pick this back up with, how the lottery system worked, how what was happening with the politics and the river management plan, and what do you remember about Crumbo and Steve Martin and Sam West and all these other people. So maybe we will pick that thread up again.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Good talking to you today.
All right. Yeah, you too. Well, hang on a second. So with that, let's wrap up this part 4 interview with Kurt Sauer. Today is September 21, 2020. My name is Tom Martin. Kurt, thank you so very much.
Thank you, Tom.